You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Marvin Smith. Alan Cardoza will not be here with us this morning. Due to the nature of our business, or his business, he's out on a runaway teen case. My co-host, which would be myself, Marvin Smith, former linebacker, charter school advocate, and ordained minister. Each week, we will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases, outright entertain you, while bringing you answers and options to raising children today in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and much, much more. With each of us having over 30 years of experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helping information who are working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. But more importantly, we like to say we're trying to make this place a better world. We'll continue to bring you some of these incredible, talented, and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Our guests today are Carrie Wilkins, PhD, and Nicole Sanicki. Kosanke, PhD. Now, Carrie is a co-founder and clinical director of CMC, which stands for Center of Motivation and Change. She is a dedicated practitioner and researcher of the most effective treatments for substance use problems and comprehensive behavior. Her expertise is regularly sought by CBS, Early Show, Fox News, Newsweek, The O Magazine, which is Oprah's magazine, and Psychology Today. Nicole is the Director of Evaluation and Family Services at CMC. In 2008, she was featured on O, The O Magazine, the article about her client's experience and treatment at CMC, which was later published in The O Big Book of Happiness, The Best of O. Carrie, Nicole, welcome to Answers to the Family.
Thanks so much for having us. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I have your book right here in front of me. I've kind of been going through it, and it's a really, I would say, very interesting take on treatment. And I'm going to let you guys share more about that yourself. But, you know, as I look at it, here's your book, which is Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change. And what I like it says, you know, Beyond Addiction. It's a powerful new book that offers an alternative to 12-step program. Its powerful message is one of hope, showing families and friends how they can use kindness, positive reinforcement, motivational and behavioral strategies to help them with their loved ones for change. So, on that note, can you please tell us some of the research that led to writing this book?
Yeah, sure. Nicole and I are not in the same room, so we're going to have a hard time deciding who's going to answer these questions. funny little pauses, but
that's okay.
You know, one of the reasons why we wrote the book is because we really feel that most consumers, you know, so most people with substance use problems, and unfortunately even more so with their families, really don't understand how much the field of addiction treatment has changed and is changing, and how much we now know, thanks to good research and good science, about how to be helpful. And there's just a lot of myths out there about what you need to do if your loved one has a substance use problem. So we tackled that big job and decided to write Beyond Addiction, and really did try to fill the book with all of the latest research in a way that family members could absorb easily, so that they're just better educated about the problem, better educated about how motivation works, how the brain is affected by substance use, and really what they can do to improve things, both for themselves and their loved one.
Well, thank you. It's really interesting because, you know, as I think about, when I think about communities and neighborhoods, families, and, you know, when we look at the statistics, it's like addiction impacts 1 in 4 families in the United States. I mean, that's a major issue. And I, you know, otherwise 1 in 4, that means someone, if it's not in your family, someone close to your family or someone next to your family is dealing with addictions. And I've had the opportunity personally, you know, working with troubled teens and dealing with crisis intervention and family and things of that nature, to see addiction at its worst. And it's a monster.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sadly, sadly prevalent problem. And I think there's a lot of, as Carrie was saying, there's a lot of misinformation about what you're supposed to do in the face of it. And I think one of the things we were felt so strongly about is that, you know, families, I think, don't get a lot of attention in terms of how they can be supported through this process. And, you know, if you go to your doctor or your neighbor and say, hey, I'm really worried about my son or my husband, you know, you're likely to be met with kind of blank faces or maybe even sort of made to feel ashamed or guilty about staying in a relationship even with somebody who has a problem. So, you know, we really felt strongly that families need a lot more information and a lot more support, because there's so many families struggling out there and really deserve more support themselves in terms of, you know, concrete strategies for how to help themselves and how to help their loved one when they're really struggling with this.
Well, you know, Carrie and Nicole, I mean, as you share that, it is so important. I've looked at situations where you could have in a family someone who's struggling with addiction, and there's other siblings and there's others in the family, and all of a sudden this particular individual starts to get all the attention of the caregivers, of the parents. And then you have those other siblings or the spouse now who's being neglected. And we never see that part of it. And we never, and all of a sudden now there's other things that are starting to happen because, you know, the others they're feeling neglected. Maybe you could share something about that as you were alluding to.
Well, I was going to say you were giving the statistic of 1 in 4 family members. The counterpoint statistic that goes along with that is that they think for every substance user, there's 5 people who are suffering direct negative effects due to that substance use problem. And that's, you know, and these effects can be quite dramatic. They can be subtle. They can be ongoing for years and years, and they really touch every part of a person's life. It can be financial, it can be physical, you know, because a lot of domestic violence is a direct result of, you know, the outcome of substance use, neglect, the effect on kids, you know, and just wear and tear on the family system. So, and unfortunately, I think the message families have gotten to date is really, look, there's nothing you can do. Your loved one needs to bottom out. You need to disengage and just wait for them to hit their bottom, right? Which
I call those horrible choices.
Yeah. Eradicate that phrase. I hope we can eradicate the "they have to hit bottom" phrase from just the dialogue in this country.
Well, you know, I've always heard that the saying "tough love." You know, just you have to ignore them, just let them go through it, let them bottom out, and then once they come to their senses, then we can help them.
Right. Which, as you have probably witnessed in your work, can lead to tragic consequences, often life-ending consequences.
Yes.
So, to really educate and empower family members that they can do a lot, and not in a self-sacrificing way. I mean, the treatment that we talk about in the book is something called community reinforcement approach and family training. So it really is focused on building up the community around the substance user so that that community can be healthy and have a positive impact on the substance user's life. And to kind of help parents and to help family members, spouses, to really realize, wow, I can change how I talk about the problem. I can change kind of the structure of our day or what happens in our home. You know, I can change the things that I can really have an impact on in a way that could possibly really have a good effect on my loved one. And that's really what family members want. They want to have an effect. They don't want to be told, do nothing. It goes absolutely against every instinct they have.
Exactly. And I like what you said. Education. You know, being able to equip families, loved ones, that they're educated on the subject matter, that there are options and there are things they can do practically that make a difference. And I like what, you know, community reinforcement approach and family training, which I guess the acronym is CRAF. Can you elaborate more about that?
Well, sure. You know, the community reinforcement approach has been around for several decades, and that's really an approach designed to, like Carrie was saying, like really address the community around a substance user in such a way that sobriety, abstinent behaviors, healthy, constructive behaviors are really supported, and that, you know, the negative behaviors have less and less space and room to be growing. So that's been an approach that's been around for a while, and the community reinforcement and family training piece was really an offshoot of that, using the same principles and specifically targeting how can we work with the families when the substance user themselves is really directly resisting going into treatment. You know, people that really are not ready for treatment, they don't feel motivated yet, et cetera. But the families worry, the families concerned, they see warning signs and they're ready to act. So the CRAFT approach is this terrific, you know, positive reinforcement focused treatment strategy that really works with family members, and the substance user isn't even in the room. You know, working with the family to help train them around communication strategies, around positive reinforcement strategies. You know, how do you really identify the positive behaviors that you want to be nourishing and have growing? And how do you be a good role model for the person that you're worried about? How do you interact with them in a way that helps reinforce that your boundaries are solid ones and you're taking good care of yourself, and you're also willing and ready to be engaged in the positive behaviors that might compete with the negative substance abusing behaviors? You know, so for instance, yes, parents who are really worried about a kid who is smoking too much pot or drinking too much on the weekends, you know, what are the things that they can do to model healthy behaviors and be participating and organizing this kid's life in such a way that it sort of squeezes out the room for substance abuse and acknowledges the reasons that the kid might be using in the first place and sort of addressing those. So there's this wide range of strategies mm-hmm. that CRAFT involves to really help family members understand what they can be doing in an active way. And as Carrie said, you know, not in a self-sacrificing way, in a way that really respects the needs of the family members and understands sort of what they can do to be helpful for the person they're concerned about.
Good. So as I'm listening to what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong. So I can't be a parent then who's sitting here smoking pot and then tell my kid, says, you know, we have a problem with this. Do as I say, don't do as I do. So, have you seen that before?
Oh, for sure. You know, we
sadly,
there's so many parents who, you know, they come in and they talk about, I think my kid is smoking pot because they can't handle the school pressure, or they have a hard time saying no to their friends, or, you know, and we often say, like, look, if you're, and this isn't to give parents a hard time about their substance use, but just really helping them realize that their kids are watching them all the time, right?
Yes, they are.
All the time. And if your child is watching you come home from work and pour yourself a drink in order to wind down from that stress, mm-hmm. that they are watching, that's a skill that they're watching you do, right?
Yes,
it's like,
yes.
I manage my anxiety by having a drink. I manage my...
Yes. Hello?
Did we lose her?
I think we did.
Oh, dear. Well, I can continue.
You can continue from there. You continue. Well, Carrie, you continue from there, and I will see in the station if we can get her back on. So,
okay.
Go ahead. But you can continue, Carrie, and while we'll work on that here.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the role modeling effect for family members is really, especially parents, but also for spouses. You know, we role model for each other all the time in terms of healthy behaviors and negative behaviors.
Yes.
They do so many studies that
show... Thank you for calling Center for Motivation and Change, okay. The crossroads of science and kindness.
Sorry.
If you know your party...
Having a little technical difficulties here.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carrie.
Oh, so I was just saying, you know, that the role modeling effect is quite profound. They do so many studies on this that really show that kids listen far more attentively to the tone of voice, to the behaviors they witness. So if a parent is saying one thing and doing another, the kid is really only hearing the doing. It's only hearing the example being set. It's only hearing the tone of voice and the behaviors that he's witnessing in terms of the modeling, and really not hearing the words. So I think, a lot of parents really underestimate this effect and think that, you know, having a lecture or really explaining the reasons why their kids shouldn't smoke pot or drink too much is going to have the effect they want to have. But actually having a much greater effect is whether or not they're drinking in front of their kids, and whether or not they're really getting intoxicated, and whether or not the way that their relationship is with alcohol is really one of medicating stress or anxiety or depression. That has a huge impact.
You know, you always hear the term behavior modeling. And my wife, we always talk about having grandkids and kids. But, you know, that whole thing, she always says, it's not what's taught, it's what's caught. Otherwise, you know, it's you're telling them one thing, but they're being very observant and they're watching the behavior. And that's sending a strong message. So you're correct in what you're saying.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, it puts a lot of pressure on parents, and there's a lot of pressure on parents already. There's no shortage of ways to feel guilty as a parent. There's no question about that. But the truth is this is an opportunity for parents to have a healthier life, too. You know,
yes.
To really be thinking about the ways that they treat their emotions, the ways they handle stress. And for themselves, you know, doing the right thing and being healthier is really going to have a tremendously positive impact on the kids as well. And I think as a culture, we don't do a great job with this. You know, people medicate their feelings left and right. You know, having a drink when you're feeling stressed out, commenting about it is really, it's commonplace. And so I think that it sort of goes unnoticed. You know, it's sort of in the ether, in the background, and doesn't really get noticed as having an impact in that way.
Right. And I think we have Nicole's back online. Nicole, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, so anyway.
Back. Yeah, got us both.
But anyway, Carrie did a good job. She took off where you left off and so, looking at parenting and the results of that behavior modeling and how we deal with stress. So in the process, you want to pick up where she left off?
No, I was just I was also going to say one of the things that parents really struggle with is, I think, feeling very worried that they are the cause of the problem somehow.
Good.
You know, that they're not doing something right. So as much as we're also saying, hey, your kids are watching you and you're modeling lots of things to them, so be mindful of that. The other tension that we're trying to help them kind of tease apart is, you know, the reality is your kids really are exposed to a lot of stuff out there in the world that's really complicated and is probably stuff that you were not exposed to as a kid, you know, with all of the stuff online.
Social media, yes.
You know, just everything that they're exposed to. So your kids are going to be making decisions that you may or may not have any awareness of, that they're, that you know, because it's just different than what it was when you grew up as a kid. So to not feel horribly ineffective and guilty as a parent either, because I think a lot of parents kind of don't ask for help and they don't deal with a substance problem in their child kind of right out of the gates because they hope they'll just grow out of it.
Yes.
And there's a lot of shame, you know, attached to having a substance use problem in your house. So, and it just goes underground. You know, so what we really hope the book does is kind of empower people to really, again, just get educated and also feel hopeful, you know, that you can have an impact and you can have an effect on your child, on your spouse, and it can be really positive.
You know, I would say this, that some of the things that you're sharing, you would think could be common sense. But then I guess when you look at it from the standpoint of, you know, guilt and shame and these factors start to become part of the environment, you know, what we would normally do, common sense goes out the door, you know. And I say
it's
tough being a parent these days. It's much different when I was growing up. Like I say, it was very limited. I mean, and when I was growing up, if you did something wrong, if you were out of alignment, if you were across town, there were parents on the other side of town that would call home and says, Marvin is doing something he shouldn't be doing. And I was more in fear of getting home than, you know, that call getting there. So it's like, but nowadays it's like, it's not my kid. It's not my issue. You know, I think even as a society, it's changed over the years as far as, you know, us taking responsibility as a community. That's why I kind of really love that the community reinforcement approach. Because it's bringing in those other factors and other people and things around the situation to make it better in a positive sense.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this then. How does CRAFT compare to the popular 12-step program or method? Is there a difference? Is it the same? What makes it uniquely different?
You want me to... So I can say a few things,
sure.
And then
yes.
I'm sure Nicole will
okay.
follow up with a lot more. The reality is, you know, if you think about it, the 12-step community is a community, right?
Yes, yes,
it's
it
an
is.
Unbelievably helpful community to a lot of people. It reaches a lot of people. It's free. It's incredibly supportive. And so it's a great model of the power of a community, right?
Yes.
The problem is it doesn't work for everybody, and we know that. And I think one of the reasons why addiction treatment kind of success rates in this country have not been great is because we've just been using this kind of one-size-fits-all model. I think substance use disorders are complex. They often have, you know, there's often the substance use problem, but then underneath that problem there's some sort of, you know, psychiatric mm-hmm. issue, anxiety, depression, trauma. There's a massive amount of trauma that is often underneath a substance or kind of commingled with a substance problem.
Mm-hmm.
So to be kind of really thinking about the whole picture, right? And
yes.
really what needs to get addressed in order for a substance use problem to kind of get resolved. You got to look at it from lots of different angles and be willing to talk about it in lots of different ways. So I think the community reinforcement and family training is a very specific treatment intervention that was designed for people whose loved ones didn't want to go to treatment, right? So
right.
for people who are like, I don't have a substance problem. What are you talking about? I don't want to go. And so they take the spouse or they take the parent who is concerned and they bring them in and they teach them these skills. And what they've learned is that they get their loved one into treatment at a much higher rate than some of the other strategies that are more often suggested, like an intervention, you know, like a,
right.
a standard intervention, or to Al-Anon. And so Al-Anon is another, like, lovely self-help organization. It's not designed to get people into treatment, right? It's designed to get loved ones healthy. It's like
healthy.
A community for them, right?
Right.
So, but, you know, most people want to get their loved one into treatment, right?
Right.
That's what they're looking for. So CRAFT really has been proven time and again to do just that at a much more kind of successful rate than these other two things, yet these other two things are what are typically suggested to people. Like
right.
if I'm a spouse or I'm a parent and I say, God, I'm really worried about my son, or, you know, my son's using heroin, or my husband's coming home drunk every night. What a layperson and what a lot of treatment providers will recommend is, oh, you should go do an intervention, or you should go to an Al-Anon meeting. Those may be good suggestions and they may not be. And nobody knows about craft, which is shocking because it's been proven in lots of studies to be really effective. So, you know, we're just wanting to put yet another option out there for people to pick up because they really, family members need a lot. They need a lot of support and they need a lot of options.
Well, it sounds...
I'll just add to that, if I could. Like, one of the things that we have looked at in terms of the studies and the research around this is really doing head-to-head studies for these three approaches. Like, craft, as Gary said, which nobody's heard of, but is an option out there. And then Al-Anon, and then an intervention. And when you do kind of the head-to-head study, you know, sending a parent or a spouse to one of these three approaches to help get the loved one into treatment, craft just soars past these other approaches in terms of the numbers of people entering treatment. So they usually get people into treatment like 65 to 75% of the time, whereas interventions get people into treatment about 30% of the time, and Al-Anon about 12% of the time. And as Gary said, you know, it's not fair to compare these approaches in a certain way because Al-Anon really isn't designed to do that. But the reason to look at these three approaches in a head-to-head kind of way is that this is what we got. This is sort of what's available in the world. So when you think about, you know, what a family member is going to be told by a layperson, their doctor, a priest, whomever they might go to for help, you know, is typically going to be Al-Anon or an intervention. And these are definitely going to be helpful and definitely the right approach for some people, but it really doesn't work for everyone. And it's really important that people know there are options available out there because interventions sort of represent the opposite ends of the continuum in terms of activity on the part of the family member. So an intervention is very dramatic, confrontational, getting in there kind of approach. And Al-Anon is let him hit bottom, detach with love, that kind of thing. So it's like the opposite ends of the continuum, whereas craft really takes the approach of, you know, the more that you're engaged, the more you are really utilizing the leverage of a relationship and getting in there, participating in the things that are healthy and encouraging those things, the more effect you can have in that relationship. And not just getting into somebody into treatment, which is obviously most people's first goal, but, you know, also longer term. You know, how is this relationship going to sustain these changes once the person has made them? Because unfortunately, it's not usually just a sort of hit by lightning kind of thing. You know, it's usually, okay, I'm ready, I'm doing this. Oh, I have to keep doing this. Oh, I have a whole life to support around these new changes.
Oh, yes.
It's tough in the long run.
Well, it's interesting that you share that. There's a few thoughts that come to mind. You can't see me in the studio, but I have this big smile on my face because I, as you're talking about intervention, you know, it reminds me of the show you see on TV, and all of a sudden the particular person who's dealing with addiction is, the way it looks to me, is just kind of teamed up on. All of a sudden, you know, all these family members are in a place like, you need to go to treatment. And then you see them trying to administer love, but at that moment, and that person's not ready, and I love what you're saying about relationship, the relational part of it. If we haven't been nurturing that, and as it reminds me of, you know, education, K-12 education today, because I'm part of that reform part of that, it's one shoe doesn't fit all. And it's really being able to manage that situation, and it's a lot easier in a relational aspect than teaming up on the person, you know, or letting them hit rock bottom, which when you look at the statistics show that, you know, the results of that are very low in performance. So craft, we need more craft out there. And we're not talking about craft foods either.
No. Velveeta cheese, is that
craft? Yes.
Yeah, and one of the, you know, so there's a lot of people out there who are going to counter this discussion with, look, I would be dead if my family hadn't done an intervention, right?
Yes.
And for sure, many people have been saved by that route. Our problem with that is that it's typically just presented as, hey, this is the only thing you can do.
Right.
Which that is just not true. And one of the things that we know about interventions, and this has been part of what's come out of these studies, is that a lot of family members, they just actually don't, they can't they can't follow through with it. They'll think, oh, an intervention sounds like a great idea, and then they just can't do it. Because it's ultimately a pretty confrontational, very direct thing, you know.
Yes.
And you're really saying to the person, if you don't go to rehab, or if you don't do what we're saying we want you to do in this moment, then we're going to cut off contact with you. We're not going to talk to you anymore, or we're not going to support you financially, or we're not, you know. So there's an ultimatum that's kind of part of that intervention, which is a really intense thing to do.
Yes,
and you really
is.
Have to be prepared to really, like, change the locks on your door. They can't come home if they don't go to rehab. And so I think a lot of people will think, oh, that's a good idea, I need to do that, but then they just can't because it's hard, and it's scary, and it's complicated. And so to be able to kind of give people these other set of skills, you know, that are part of craft, which is like, look, stay engaged, but stay engaged in a really strategic way and be thoughtful about how you're engaged. Really focus on positive behaviors that you can reinforce, right? So there's a bunch of stuff you can support when your loved one's sober, when your loved one's talking to you in a nice way, when your loved one's being helpful around the house. Take notice of that, right? Compliment
right.
it. Take notice of that. Reward it. If your loved one's intoxicated or being destructive or being abusive, that's the time to kind of remove yourself in a strategic moment. Like, don't engage with that stuff. We're not
right.
saying that. Like, go to your bedroom and close the door and watch TV or read a book or go out with a friend. Like, remove yourself from that. But the problem is a lot of spouses and family members will just remove themselves from the whole equation, right? They're just like, ugh. I can't do anything.
Can't do anything, right.
And they, right, and they just back up and they lose all the leverage that they have around the positive stuff.
Yes.
So the whole system gets really negative. There's just fighting, there's negativity, there's pessimism, and that's a pretty toxic stew for anybody to live in. And Kraft really says, look, let's get you, the family member, healthy. We really, really want to focus on your self-care. We want to make sure you're, like, taking the breaks that you need, getting the support that you need, and then we're going to help you think strategically and be really thoughtful. And Nicole can weigh in more about this. One of the things Kraft does very strategically is let naturally occurring consequences play a bigger role, because what you'll sometimes see is that family members, they become the consequence, right?
Yes, okay.
I'm mad at you, right? If I'm just mad at you enough, or if I fall into tears enough, or if I cry enough, or if I plead enough, maybe you'll change, right? And so what unfortunately happens is they become the problem.
Right.
Instead of the substance user's behavior becoming a problem. And what you really want the substance user is to realize, wow, when I drink too much, the world responds to me in a way that's not so great. I don't like how that feels. And that's something that family members often have lost sight of. Nicole,
right.
do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think what can really exacerbate that kind of problem is the high levels of shame involved in this problem. So, you know, I work with a lot of parents, and you can really see how shame has interrupted their natural instincts around how to deal with problems. Like, they feel like they need to shelter their kid, for instance, or their husband from experiencing the consequences in the world, because then more people will know that there's a problem. And, you know, maybe there will be negative stigmatism that occurs that really impacts the family in a negative way. So, for instance, you know, I'm often hearing parents who are saying, well, my sister called and said, like, how is he doing? You really didn't look so good at that wedding. You know, how are you? What's happening? And, you know, people will say, oh, it's okay. You know, we're working on it, and try and appease the person. Whereas, you know, really a community approach that didn't involve shame for the problem, if it were any other kind of problem, you would say, you know, this is exactly what's going on. Can you help me? You know,
right.
you would enlist the person's help. You would say, you know what, it would be great if you actually called him directly and told him what you were concerned about, you know, what you saw, what made you worried. And that's a natural consequence for people in the world to say, like, hey, what's going on? Like, you were kind of rude to your brother there, or, you know, you seem like really out of control that night. Are you okay? And that's confronting with sort of a small c. It's like being direct about what you're seeing and observing and encouraging other people to do the same. not with a punitive tone or a derogatory tone, but actually encouraging the world to give those consequences directly to the person who's using, as opposed to sort of coming around the bend towards you as a family member, as the person who's supposed to be delivering all of this bad news, because that family member is likely to get sort of scapegoated by the substance user, you know,
right.
Oh, it's just you, you're worried about this, you know, they don't really think that's a problem, or nobody else noticed that but you,
yeah.
Or why are you still on my back, or something, you know, these are sadly the kinds of deflecting things that people do when they feel like, you know, it's really just this one person, I'm not hearing
right.
this from other people.
Well, you know, the thing I look at it too, is I call it the big cover-up. You know, we're covering, on one hand, we don't want the outside world to really know the extent of what's happening. And then the other part I see is too is a fear, how that person who's in the crisis, you know, the abuser, then starts to abuse people around them. Because when they're, you know, under the influence, you know, they become very combative. These other things come out. So sometimes some of the things I've seen is where now you have parents or those loved ones who are in fear to even engage them, even in normal activities. And then they appease them through the process. So it's like this vicious cycle. And I'm looking outside, looking in, like, we have to approach the issue in love, but you cannot continue to go down this pathway.
Yeah, no, and that's a very, those are some sticky issues. You know, we spend a fair amount of time in the book and in the craft training protocols, there's a lot of stuff about domestic violence, right? Like,
yes.
Really how to protect yourself, how to develop exit strategies, how to think about, you know, whether or not you should be in this relationship or not. So it's not like this is all just love and kindness all the time in spite
right.
of horrific things happening. Again, I really like to drive home the point that this is pretty strategic stuff, right? It's not just, hey, let's hope this gets better and be all positive. It's very, very focused on reinforcing specific positive things and setting limits around, you know, destructive things and letting the world play a role in it. Because, like Nicole said, you know, family members will often kind of inadvertently be protecting their loved one from
yes.
kind of feeling the effects of their substance use. And this is the classic phrase of, like, enabling, right? Don't enable. You know, but parents will spend all sorts of time in the morning trying to get their kid up to go to school, right? Like, and the kids stayed up all night smoking pot, and the parent is completely stressed out in the morning trying to get their kid up to school on time. I'll often say to parents, you know what? You got to let him, like, miss school a couple times. And then he needs to go to the principal and talk to the principal about the effect of, you know what, you're going to be in summer school. If you miss school again one more time, you're going to be in summer school. And then you need to let your kid be in summer school.
Like, but otherwise, it's, you know, like letting them be accountable. What you're saying is basically put them in a position, they become accountable for their behavior.
Right. You know, but it's easy for us to say, and it's
yes.
actually pretty hard to implement. You know, it's a really scary thing if your spouse's job is your family's livelihood to, and he gets drunk at night and can't get up in the morning and is going to get fired if you don't call in sick for him. Well, that's a really difficult thing for a loved one to figure out what to do with, right?
Right.
Do I let him have a consequence and let his boss be mad at him? Or do I get them up because I need the paycheck because I've got three kids?
Yes.
You know, that's one of the things that we're saying to families, to spouses and parents, is like, you've got to get some support for this, because these are really hard things to figure out, and you can't do it in a vacuum. And sometimes you might need a therapist. Sometimes you might need a group. Sometimes you might need to be going to church and talking to your minister or your rabbi. You can really, or just open up to a couple of your safe friends. But trying to make these decisions in a vacuum is really scary and really difficult and is taxing to you both physically and mentally. So one of the nice things about craft that they found is that the family members who participate in this, we focus so much on their self-care that by the time their loved one goes to treatment, so their loved ones are more likely to go to treatment, right, than these other two options.
Right.
And then the other positive thing that you see is that the well-being of the family goes up. So anger, depression, kind of stress levels, everything improves in the family system as a whole because, you know, the loved ones are really taking the time they need, and they're getting the support they need. So they're not just running around rescuing and focusing on the substance user all the time. They're really also getting taught skills to focus on themselves, which, again, is just super important for the whole system.
Right. Now, what I like, in the book, Beyond Addiction, and like you say, there's all the latest research. There are specific strategies. I mean, so there's this template. There's things that you can strategically do in this process. And it's not, as you were saying, Nicole and Carrie, it is very specific in pointing and getting at the addiction in a very positive manner, which I like. And that brings me to this whole question about, when you talk about kindness being part of the integral part of interaction, how does that tie in? If you look at craft, how is that an anchor to the situation? And I want to say this before you answer. I'm reminded, I always had a scenario called the iceberg syndrome. We as we think about behavior, we always look at the symptoms. The 10% of the iceberg is what we see, but there's another 90% below the surface we never see, and those are the drivers, and we actually never get to the drivers, and we're always trying to treat what we see, and it never works. And the reason, the treatment to that is very minimal. So what I like about the book, you're getting down to the drivers. You're getting down to the below the iceberg and looking at change, which is great.
I think that's a really, really nice analogy, because I think there are so many instances, and this is why it's so important to individualize a situation. There is not one answer for each family. There's so many situations that are so complex. There's a psychiatric symptom or syndrome that's sort of underneath a substance abuse problem that gets uncovered. There's trauma, that is the driving force of these negative behaviors. There's all sorts of relationship, disjointed relationships that can cause different problems. So there's so many different pieces that are at play when a substance abuse problem develops that it makes sense that there's going to be so many different ways that people can find their way out of these problems. And I think one of the things about the word kindness that we are fond of is that it's really addressing this issue of, if you think about any other problem that we encounter as human beings, and there are plenty of them, we don't address any other problem in this way that we've come to address substance abuse, in the sense that, this idea that you have to confront and you have to really educate the person about, how terrible drugs are, et cetera. This is not what is most helpful to people. When people feel cornered, when they feel like there's no options for them, when they feel like they're being punished or denigrated for having a problem, they are not empowered to make their own choices. They do not feel that sense of agency that they need to really grab hold of what their reasons are for making changes. And believe me, when people have these kinds of problems, there's always a piece of them that knows that they're going awry, that knows that they need to make changes and that wants to. And so in the book, we talk about, what are the windows of opportunity that the person you're worried about feels motivated themselves, and you can take advantage of those windows of opportunity and really join with them. I know you're worried about this like I am. What can I do to help? Offering to help. There are all these different communication strategies like offering to help that we help people think about, and really thinking through how can you use kindness as the leverage that it really is, because you're joining with a part of that person that really wants to make changes. And sometimes it's hard to find that part of the person, but it's there,
really
and
mad.
You can be confident.
Well,
I'll hop on for a larger discussion, which is just, our prison systems are the perfect example of how we're failing, to deal with this problem. They're packed full of substance users who we've said, you got to punish them, right? You got to punish this problem out of them. It's not working.
Well, the recidivism rate, it's like 90%. So,
But just in terms of why they're there in the first place,
right?
I mean, substances affect people's brains. They affect the reward centers of the brain. And they often, you can literally think for some people of them as hijacking their brain, right?
Yep.
It just makes it so they're not making decisions that would otherwise be consistent with their who they think of themselves, right?
Right.
Because they're craving or they're in withdrawal or they're, you know, desperate in some way that as a non-substance user, you can't even necessarily relate to because your brain's never kind of been in that state.
Right.
So really starting to treat this problem for the medical, psychological, psychiatric community problem that it is, and the reason why you see higher substance use, I mean, you'll see higher substance use in kind of impoverished groups, right? Because
yes.
The world around them is not satisfying. The world around them doesn't feel good. The world around them is full of violence or poverty or neglect or a variety of other things. So it makes a lot of sense. When you strip it down to that, of like, and you know what? Getting high feels good for a little bit. It feels good. So if we're going to really help these larger populations kind of shift and heal and, you know, the world to become a better place,
nice.
I think we've got to say, okay, these communities need to be tended to. We need to be enriching communities, enriching schools, enriching parents' involvement with their children, because this is the stuff that competes with substance use. It doesn't, yelling at people, confronting people, ripping people down, stripping people down to kind of, you know, confront their denial isn't effective. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
We've seen it time and time again, and in so many in research studies, and you can see it in the prison populations. We've got to change course here. So I'm hoping that, you know, this kind of shifting the conversation towards kindness when it comes to dealing with substance use will actually help many layers of the problem.
You know, we're down to, we have a few more minutes left before we have to wind down the show here. And are there any closing thoughts? We have a couple of call-in questions, but they, as I read the questions, they're answered in your book. And I want to just, as our listeners and these calling questions, I just want to refer them to pick up the book. It's really, there's a lot of strategies, a lot of research. I think as Nicole and Carrie were sharing, it's information that is there that will really support those questions. So
and one other thing, one other resource I'd love to steer you guys to, because, you know, we're spoiled in New York City. We've got lots of resources and lots of access to stuff. And
A minute. Hold on. You mean you're saying
Nicole
we don't have that in California? I mean, geez.
Well, Nicole and I grew up in the middle of the country, and we know there's not a ton of resources, you know, in lots of areas.
Yes.
And so we developed, there's another website. So our website for the Center of Motivation and Change is motivationandchange.com.
Okay.
We've tried to fill the website with tons of resources, blogs, other, you know, websites that have information, but we also developed another website called The 20-Minute Guide. So, and that is two kind of workbooks, and you can download the sessions for free. You can purchase the workbook for, I think, like $13. But those are full of very strategic, kind of positive, motivational tools for both parents and partners to use, because we just want people to have access and, you know, stuff at their fingertips to be helpful.
That's very informative. Can you give that information one more time, the website for the listeners?
Okay, so you've got Motivation and Change, all one word, all spelled out. You've got the20minuteguide.com. And then the Partnership for Drug-Free America, we have trained a bunch of parent mentors up. And so you can actually get on their hotline and talk to a parent coach who's been trained in these strategies. And those parents are unbelievably compelling and committed, and you can reach them at 855-DRUG-FREE.
Well, I would have to say
the other website is just the book website, which is beyondaddictionbook.com. But, you know, the motivationandchange.com website really does have a lot of articles, and I'll just say, you know, this is a lot of different things to access and resources available. And the main reason to put all this stuff out there is to really let people know that there is hope. You know, there's reason for optimism here. You know, there's a lot of tragedy and stress and anxiety and fear around these issues. And I think it poses an obstacle to people actually reaching out for help. And that's part of why we've put all this stuff together, is to really be one way for people to reach out in an easier way through the internet, to be able to educate themselves and get support and understand the things they can do to help themselves and have the impact they want with their loved ones.
Thank you. Thank you. Once again, we have Carrie Wilkins, co-founder and clinical director of CMC, Center for Motivation and Change. And we also have Nicole Kosinski, who is director for evaluation and family services at CMC. We want to thank you for your time. We've enjoyed you guys. I could have went on for hours and hours. This is just such great information.
You'll just have to have us back.
Yes, we will. Yeah. We will. I'll have our producer follow up. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.